This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. In today's program, a remarkable assertion by the Iranian delegation to the International Atomic Energy Agency, revealing an explosive attack on power lines to an Iranian nuclear facility exactly 1 month ago on the 17th of August, 2012. We will hear that presentation in its entirety. That was made just a short time earlier today. Also, there is confusion and contradiction regarding the attack on the United States consulate in Benghazi, Libya. Now, the Obama administration is denying that there was any pre-coordination of the highly complex military attack, not only on the consulate, but on a safe house a mile away. We will be speaking live with investigative reporter Pepe Escobar of Asia Times about what just happened in Benghazi. This is 5 o'clock shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. Stay tuned for that and more. This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacific Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And the mystery continues to enshroud the events at the consulate of the United States over the past several days that resulted in the deaths of at least four Americans, including the United States ambassador to Libya. And in that regard, there are conflicting stories coming from Libyan officials and from American officials. The latest dispute is the United States ambassador to the United Nations saying that there was no prior coordination of the attack, as far as she claims that the Obama administration knows at this point in time. Ambassador Susan Rice insisted over the weekend in calling the attack spontaneous and saying that the attackers were trying to replicate the less severe demonstration and flag burning and embassy wall breach in Cairo. There are conflicting accounts, however, from people inside Libya in the militia-ruled so-called government that was set up by the United States and NATO bombing and clandestine activities that resulted in the overthrow of the Libyan Arab Jamahiriya and the sodomizing death of the Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. The so-called current present Libyan president Mohamed Megarif is speaking completely differently from Ambassador Rice in regard to that, saying that the attackers were, as he claimed, foreign infiltrators who had been planning the attack for months and took advantage of the security instability inside Libya. And this is 5 o'clock shadow. We'll go into more detail with that. We're very happy to have with us investigative reporter Pepe Escobar of the Asia Times. And welcome back to 5 o'clock shadow, Pepe. And what do you know about what happened in Benghazi? Was that a spontaneous thing, or was it highly coordinated and thereby previously planned by agencies or parties unknown?
Hi, Robert. Thanks for having me again. Look, basically, this was a very well-planned and coordinated operation. The pretext, of course, was the protests that were carried out simultaneously in Benghazi and Cairo. These protests, they were called basically by an Egyptian TV station that is controlled by Salafi jihadis. This means the Salafis, the so-called purists of Islam, they are very intolerant as well. They want an interpretation of Islam that harks back to the 7th century. And some of them are jihadis of, as we in the West know, as the Al-Qaeda brand, let's put it this way. So they got 25% of the votes in Egypt in the past elections. They also got a lot of votes in Libya, although they are not in power in Libya. Some of them, by the way, a very important character, Abdel Hakim Belhaj, which is the leader of the Libyan Islamic fighting group. Now he's he's in a position of power in Tripoli as well, and he's still the military commander in Tripoli. But there are different strands to these Salafi jihadis. There are people who basically want, but they are not violent, and those in an Al-Qaeda vein, let's put it this way, that preach armed struggle, hardcore armed struggle, so we can have a caliphate spanning the whole Muslim world. When they called these protests, the pretext, of course, was this absolutely crude production, which is not even a movie, a finished movie, in fact. And we started to learn more about it only in the past few days. But the whole thing was there for almost a year. And the trailer was on the net, but when the trailer was translated to English, was translated from English with the Arabic subtitles and put on YouTube. Then we have imams all over the Muslim world calling for protest, including hardcore people in Egypt. In Libya, it was the same thing. So when this thing happened, the undercurrent of it was that the Salafi jihadis in Libya profited from it to attack the U.S. consulate. And this is the narrative on the ground, the best one that we have for the moment. The whole thing started with protests, but then a heavily armed gang with as many as 100, perhaps more people, then they broke out of it and they attacked the consulate with RPGs, in fact. In fact, one RPG practically demolished, was a very rudimentary structure that the consulate, in fact. The most important thing is there was no defense. The ambassador was practically unprotected. There were very few people, and it was very easy to overrun the consulate in the end. So no wonder a lot of people in the U.S. are saying that the State Department threw their own ambassador in Libya under the bus.
We're speaking with Pepe Escobar. And Pepe, various reports that we have seen here indicate a number of things. Number one, that the attack on the consulate was very professionally flanked with the RPGs and the small arms and machine gun fire. But this is a telling thing that comes from a security official of the United States that was involved in the attempted evacuation of other embassy or consulate staff and personnel, their evacuation to a safe house that was on the order of a mile away. And yet, the attackers had precision pinpoint mortar range on that second safe house, creating magnificent problems for the United States Marine evacuation team, causing logistical difficulties with there being more people than there were vehicles to evacuate them. But the prior knowledge of where the safe house was and the triangulation on it and the precision of the assault, once again, puts a question mark over what the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations is claiming, that this was spontaneous. What do you make of those details, in addition to the withdrawal of so-called Libyan security forces, and a report that I have read from an airline pilot in Benghazi, who was also a member of a Benghazi militia, who said that there was no call to come and protect, support, or do backup on this. There are many suspicious elements about this story. What do you make of those? And who do you think might have been involved?
Exactly. That's a very good question, because the military precision and the way it was extremely well organized, and their timing, in fact, and the fact that they were able to manipulate the process only, let's say, after a few minutes that the protest has already started. This points to, two very credible sources. One of them is the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, which from the beginning was an ally of the so-called NATO rebels, especially in Cyrenaica. They are based in of the desert, which historically has provided a lot of lead fighters, Al-Qaeda. In fact, I went north of Kabul in 2000, and I was not allowed to interview people over there. But I was told by the people at the camp that there were a lot of Libyans there. From those Libyans was Abdel Hakim Belhaj and Abu Yahya al-Libi, which was until June 4th this year, was al-Qaeda's number two. And he was called by, he was killed by a drone in Waziristan on June 4th. And the first time that Ayman al-Zawahiri, current al-Qaeda leader, admitted it, was on a tape that he set out before 9/11. And of course, the commemoration of the 11 years of 9/11 last week. And this was a more or less a code signal for an operation in Benghazi. So this is the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, al-Qaeda connection. But there are many other Salafi jihadis, which are based in Derna, by the way, that they are not al-Qaeda. They are local Salafi jihadis. Some of them trained in their old school. They trained in Afghanistan. So in terms of military precision, they are good. Some of them train in Iraq. They are hardcore Sunni Iraqis. And don't forget that a lot of these Libyan fighters, they went to Syria as well via Iraq, many of them, some of them via Turkey. They are active in the Turkish-Syrian border, and they are conducting, when you see suicide bombing in Syria, you can be absolutely sure that the know-how comes from these Sunni Salafi jihadi Iraqis. So there is an al-Qaeda historical connection. There is a Sunni-Iraqi al-Qaeda in Iraq connection. And local Salafi jihadis based in Derna, in eastern Syria, in eastern Libya as well. This explains why the whole thing was, from a military point of view, was very, very precise. Because they have a battleground experience. Not only they were trained in military camps, they were actually fighting a war against, some of them were fighting a war, a guerrilla against the U.S. in Iraq until 3 or 4 years ago.
We're speaking with Pepe Escobar. And Pepe, can you speak to the illusion that there is an actual functioning government in Libya after the NATO-American overthrow? Can you explain how the city or the nation, Benghazi, Tripoli, all the different parts of Cyrenaica are actually under pretty much quantified mob rule, that is militias and not any central government that no longer exists there. How bad is the stability of the tribalized, Somalicized nation of Libya that once was a leader of the continent?
Exactly. That's a very good question because it debunks the myth that mostly what you read in U.S. mainstream press and European press as well, and a lot of very well-respected analysts in the U.S., they are gobbling that up, including a lot of people that I particularly respect and I'm always in contact with. It's not true that there is a functioning government in Tripoli. No way. There are suicide bombings in Tripoli every week and sometimes even 2 or 3 days. It reminds me of Iraq in 2004, 2005, for that matter. The country is ruled by militias. The militias did not disarm, none of them. If they are not part of the new power configuration in Tripoli, they want to rule their own systems. For instance, in Misrata, rule does not apply. It's the Misrata militias that control Misrata. In Benghazi, it's the same thing. There are a lot of different militias in Benghazi. Some that are collaborating with the government, and some that want to overthrow the government already. This is something that a lot of us have predicted even before Gaddafi fell. It is militia hell. There's no question. And the fact that the ambassador was there, one of the missions of Ambassador Stevens was to try to rein in this militia hell in Benghazi. I'm not sure he would be successful. The other mission was also very important. He was there for an oil meeting with Benghazi executives. Because don't forget that the oil in Libya is mostly in the eastern part. It is in Cyrenaica. And one of the main reasons for the whole Libyan adventure is to control Libya's oil wealth. And, of course, American multinationals are involved, but also Europeans as well. And the excluded are the Russians and the Chinese. So Ambassador Stevens was in Benghazi to talk about oil. That was his number one brief, in fact. So this plays very well with, I would say most of the Libyan population, because a lot of people are suspicious of NATO's motives and U.S. motives as well. They want to see how a new oil law will be written in Libya, who is going to write it, and how it's going to be the oil exploitation, the gas exploitation in the future of Libya.
There are multiple ironies here in that J. Christopher Stevens, His Excellency the late ambassador, was like a military proconsul. He was a facilitator of the overthrow of the Libyan Arab Jamahiriya. And this brings back to us Pepe Escobar, recollections of Afghanistan and how the United States creation of and arming and funding of the so-called Mujahideen movement during the 1970s and 80s to oppose the Russian presence in Afghanistan has now many of the same players, including the Mr. Belhaj to whom you referred. And with the U.S. policy now itself embroiled in a permanent war in Afghanistan, with the jihadis and Salafis and Mujahideens coming back to haunt American ambitions in Libya and elsewhere throughout the region, including the treacherous alliance in Syria, has U.S. foreign policy blown back upon itself? And did the Obama and Clinton administration make a massive screw-up in overthrowing Libya?
Absolutely, Robert. In fact, this was the theme of, at least two of the pieces that I wrote last week. It's blowback. Totally configured blowback. But the thing is, we were expecting this kind of blowback to happen in a matter of years, probably. It happened in a matter of only a few months. And the way things are going so fast, we can expect multiple blowbacks, not only in Libya, but in case the Bashar al-Assad government falls in Syria, which is not a given anymore. Because what happened in Libya is making the State Department, the CIA, and the Obama administration, for that matter, rethink what they are doing in Libya. Because the same people who attacked the U.S. consulate in Benghazi are the same people that the U.S., Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Paris, and London are supporting in Syria. There's practically no difference. And these Salafi jihadis are exactly the same breed. In fact, many of them they are shuttling back and forth between Libya and Iraq, Libya and Syria, Libya and the Turkish-Syria border. So it's practically impossible to imagine that with so many able diplomat at the State Department, nobody has foreseen that this blowback would happen, and it will happen so fast. So if Libya, I would say, is just an entry compared to what might happen if Syria is completely fragmented or balkanized, in fact. I think it's going to be the official American policy vis-a-vis Syria, even if it's leading from behind, will change. Because now, the Obama administration, they are seeing who they are aligned with. Basically, there are two components. One is the Muslim Brotherhood, which is supported by Qatar. They are, let's put it mildly, moderate Muslims, although there are many strands within the Muslim Brotherhood. They are very active in Syria, and they want regime change in Syria as well, as they wanted regime change in Libya. And the other component is the Salafi jihadis, which are basically, conceptually, they are Wahhabis from Saudi Arabia, in fact. It's the same world vision of the Wahhabis in the House of Saud, which is an extremely intolerant regime that happens to be allied with the U.S. And not only they want regime change, but they want every one of these secular Arab republics, like Libya or like Syria, to be like Saudi Arabia, which is the reign of intolerance as expressed by Wahhabism, which is an extremely intolerant form of Islam. So I'm sure people in Washington are thinking it over again and again. And maybe we can expect, in case, of course, that Obama is reelected, rearrangement or perhaps a new pivot, as they like to say in Washington, vis-a-vis the Muslim world, North and Africa and the Middle East, the wider Middle East.
Pepe Escobar is the author most recently in the Asia Times of Brother Obama, Where Art Thou? And Mr. Blowback, Rising in Benghazi. Now, Pepe, there is a Jabberwockian absurdity of many statements coming from the Obama administration in regard to Libya. Here are three of them. The Ambassador Susan Rice to the United Nations insisted over the weekend that what happened at the consulate and then subsequently at the safe house was spontaneous. Her word. President Barack Obama at the Democratic National Convention said the words, and I quote, Al-Qaeda is on the run. And number three, Hillary Rodham Clinton, in a bizarre and gleeful maudlin statement upon the news of the death of Muammar Gaddafi, cackled as follows. We came, we saw, he died. Does this indicate to you that the State Department is being run in an unprofessional and incompetent way, and that there would be merit in the resignation of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton?
Well, can you imagine Hillary Clinton going public and saying, look, I was wrong from the beginning? This is never going to happen. Don't forget that this trio, Samantha Power, Susan Rice and Hillary Clinton, they sold humanitarian intervention R2P to Obama face to face. Obama was not convinced in the beginning. But the lobby by Hillary and the two other. So in the end, Obama was won over. But can you imagine now? And Hillary, I think a few days ago, she said, how could this thing possibly happened to Libya, a nation that we helped the Libyan people to liberate themselves. Well, of course, because you never thought in the beginning that some of the people that you were in bed with or you were helping, they would turn against you as soon as they had a chance. And this is the Salafi jihadi element, which was always very, very strong in Libya and was instrumental in the fall of Gaddafi as well. So, of course, we all know that it was a hardcore dictatorship, the 40 years plus of Gaddafi. But he was right in one thing. He said, look, this whole thing, he used to say almost every day, this is an Al-Qaeda plot. He was at least 50 or 70% correct, because it was. And especially in Eastern Libya, in Cyrenaica, his own security and intelligence services, they had arrested a lot of these people before. They knew exactly what was going on in terms of Salafi jihadist training camps in Eastern Libya. And some of these people had been pardoned in 2010 by Saif al-Islam as part of a reconciliation project in Libya. So the Libyan security services knew who they were dealing with, and they knew how important they were in the militarized front of the rebellion against Gaddafi. And of course, the CIA was on the ground as well. The French and the Brits were on the ground as well. They all knew about it. But the most important objective was the regime change. The problem is, after regime change, you never know what you're going to get. even if you study history. And in the case of Washington, most people over there, they don't learn the lessons of history. We still haven't learned what happened in Afghanistan in the 1980s, when the freedom fighters, received by Ronald Reagan at the White House in 1985, became jihadists or became the Taliban. So it's going to happen all over again in Northern Africa, and beware, it could happen all over again in Syria, and if it happens in Syria, it will expand all over the Middle East. It would mean that it will happen in Jordan, and Turkey could face a backlash as well inside their own territory. And I think only now these the foreign ministries of all these countries are starting to pay attention to it. But it's a big problem because they are financed by Saudi Arabia directly and indirectly by very wealthy individuals in the Persian Gulf through established networks or through underground networks as well. The more moderate elements are financed by Qatar, And obviously, you cannot possibly imagine that the agenda of the House of Saud and the Emir of Qatar is the same agenda of the President of the United States or the State Department.
We're speaking with Pepe Escobar of Asia Times. And Pepe, there is an immediate trigger point with the dispatch of American warships off the Benghazi coast. There is the flying of United States drones over Libya, not to mention pretty much the rest of the world, and throughout Northern Africa and Somalia. And there seems to be a primitive emotional military syndrome in which one suspects or fears that somebody is going to get bombed and hellfired to death. What are your concerns about a military escalation at this point, when even the flight of American drones out of the Benghazi airport is now drawing anti-aircraft fire with weapons that the United States helped give these so-called rebels during the overthrow of Gaddafi with the looting of the arms and weapons stores? What do you think are the immediate dangers of a United States military response and other seeming acts of incompetence?
Yes, it's a very, like you said, it is a very primitive in terms of geopolitical analysis, and it's very emotional as a response of the type, we have to do something and we have to bomb somebody. Somebody has to be blamed, or as Obama said with a fantastic euphemism, we should say, let's bring them to justice. But what kind of justice? First of all, nobody knows exactly who are these people. People is saying that they arrested 50 people. It could be anybody. It could be just like during and after the bombing in Afghanistan in 2001, when they were arresting even passersby who happened to be in the wrong place in the wrong time. Same thing could be happening in Libya. What is certain is that these training camps, that the CIA, for instance, know exactly where they are around Derna, they are going to be bombed. Perhaps in the next few hours, perhaps in the next few days. But they will be bombed. Drones are already there. It's going to give more or less the same effect as that droning and hell firing of the Waziristan, where we're going to have a lot of collateral damage. But because these are the people who attacked us in Benghazi, according to the official spin, nobody will shed a tear. Even if there is a lot of collateral damage, and this probably will be sold by the Obama administration, and in fact by U.S. mainstream media as a payback. Mm. But it's not going to solve the problem. First of all, because these Salafi jihadis, they're still there, and if they're not in Derna, they are mingling with the local population in Benghazi, in Misrata, even in Tripoli itself. Some are shuttling back and forth between Northern Africa and the Middle East. Some are being trained and retrained in Iraq. Some are being harbored by the Turks in the southern Turkish border. So it's not going to solve any problem. And on top of it, we have elections in less than 2 months. Obama doesn't want to do anything absolutely radical at the moment because he simply doesn't want to be talking about his foreign policy failure.
I would imagine that in the White House and in Foggy Bottom at the State Department, Ms. Clinton and Mr. Obama are saying to each other that the Libya fiasco could not have come at a worse time for the Syrian screw-up.
Oh, yeah. There's no question. And in fact, one of the side effects of what happened in Benghazi is that Bashar al-Assad's government in Syria will last much longer than a lot of people are imagining. Now, the Obama administration's support to the same policy will be very much muted and guarded and even more leading from behind than before. The Turks, who wanted to go all out for regime change against Syria, they got a no from NATO a month ago, more or less, and they are not going to, let's say, invade northern Syria without NATO support, and of course without United States support. Once again, on the ground, the Saudis and the Qataris financing these people. And this is the root of the problem would be for the U.S. to press upon the House of Saud something. Look, if you start financing, if you continue financing or refinancing these people, there's going to be consequences against you because now they're attacking us.
Pepe, that's where we're going to have to leave it today. I really appreciate your taking the time with the long-distance delay and telephone communications, speaking with us live from Brazil today. And Pepe Escobar is with Asia Times and most recently the author of Mr. Blowback, Rising in Benghazi, and Brother Obama, Where Art Thou? What else are you working on in the minute remaining, Pepe?
Well, I just wrote a piece about what's going on in Eurasia, in Central Asia, where, by the way, Obama's policies are also floundering. It just came out on Al Jazeera English yesterday. And next, I'll still be talking about ramifications of this. In fact, there is a very important war in the Middle East, which is the internal war among Muslims. And this is speaking the Muslim Brotherhood.
Oh, we lost the line. Pepe Escobar is the author of many important articles and investigative insights in Asia Times. And as you've heard, he was just published in another news agency that's based in Qatar. And we recommend that you read Mr. Blowback, Rising in Benghazi, as well as Brother Obama, Where Art Thou? This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight here with Tiago Barroso and Michael G. Haskins. And we conclude today's program with a remarkable statement made just a short time ago by the Iranian delegation to the International Atomic Energy Agency's General Conference that began earlier today, in which Dr. Feridun Abbasi, the Vice President of the Iranian Islamic Republic and the head of the delegation to the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, made a remarkable announcement that exactly 1 month ago, on the 17th of August, 2012, someone or something detonated the power lines going into one of the Iranian nuclear facilities. According to the ambassador and vice president, on the 17th of August, the electric power lines from the city of Qom to the Fordo complex were cut using explosives. It should be recalled that power cutoff is one of the ways to break down centrifuge machines. That statement, along with a reference to the assassination ongoing of Iranian nuclear technicians and the invasion cybernetically of Stuxnet and other destructive machine-based viruses, is part of what was said just a short time ago by Dr. Feridun Abbasi to the International Atomic Energy Agency, and we now hear that.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful, Mr. President, at the outset, allow me to express my congratulations for Your Excellency's election as the president of this important session. I hope, in light of your wise management, along with the valuable cooperation of member states, this year's session will yield fruitful results. Mr. President, distinguished delegates, the Islamic Republic of Iran, based on Islamic instructions, has always opposed and will always denounce the manufacturing and use of weapons of mass destruction. And the Supreme Leader of Islamic Republic of Iran has stressed the fact that production and application of nuclear weapons are forbidden. We do not regard nuclear weapons as instruments that can create might and power. Rather, we believe that a nation can overcome the power created by nuclear weapons through reliance on its overall natural and human resources and capabilities. The victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran and the toppling of the U.S.-backed monarchical regime is an evident example of overcoming such a power. Following the martyrdom of Dariush Reza-i Nejad, happened after the anniversary of martyrdom of Dr. Majid Shahriari, and just one day before the second anniversary of assassination of Dr. Masoud Ali Mohammadi, the Zionist agents staged another criminal act and assassinated Mr. Mustafa Ahmadi Roshan and his colleague, Mr. Reza Ashqa'i by using a sticky bomb to their moving car. In the meantime, other specialists and negotiators with the agency targeted by the terrorists that with timely protection and identification of the Ministry of Intelligence and Revolutionary Guards, they were arrested. And the news was announced by the public media. The advent of nuclear terrorism and indifference of agencies' secretariat towards that and sometimes a stereotyped and superficial response to this phenomenon could be dangerous to the specialists of other countries in the future. Mr. Mustafa Ahmadi Roshan was one of the key elements in Iran's nuclear and enrichment technology. And after he's martyred them, hundreds of academics and industrial specialists volunteered to work with Iran's atomic energy organizations, and some of them have been recruited. Distinguished delegates, in last year's meeting with the IAEA's Director General, I invited him to visit Iran's nuclear activities and facilities, and I also requested him to propose a reasonable time in order to ensure the necessary verification. A year has passed ever since, but no response has been given so far. And regrettably, the IAEA insists on its previous approach. The IAEA's approach has been such that negotiations fail to result. One can create a major obstacle along the way and then say that negotiations to overcome that obstacle have been waning. The wise solution is that the agency be more patient for what it calls verification and act more cautiously in order to respect the rights and security of a member state. It should be taken into consideration how dangerous Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and Saddam Hussein's regime were to some countries and their national security. My country has thousands of kilometers of common borders with these groups and countries, and thus our national security is much more endangered than farther, especially transatlantic countries. It is imperative that the IAEA's inspection be carried out with due consideration for the specific conditions of the region and the necessary confidence be created for the Islamic Republic of Iran. Passage of time can properly remove ambiguities, and all we need is mutual trust. Ladies and gentlemen, I draw the attention of honorable participants, independent reporters, and the world conscience to the fact that the Secretariat of the IAEA might be diverted from its principle as to impartiality and justice as a result of mismanagement and influence of certain states. All intellectuals in the world should be aware of the fact that the nuclear case of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the ambiguities that are raised in this regard stem from the annihilation of interests of the rulers of certain states in Iran and the advent of a new liberating ideology. Regrettably, the IAEA has adopted such a cynical approach. Should we wish to see things as cynically as some IAEA's authorities do without evidence and with undue insistence, we fail to continue dialogues and we would have to try other options. terrorists and saboteurs might have intruded the agency and might be making decisions covertly. We should notify His Excellency the Director General and his colleagues of this issue and give the necessary warning. I emphasize that one can look at events and reports cynically and to reach a conclusion and thus create troubles for nations that can live in peace and promote civilization based on the unity of God the Almighty. Providing some examples could clarify the roots of our concerns. On Friday 27th of Murdad, 1391 Iranian calendar, corresponding to 17th August 2012, the electric power lines from the city of Qom to Fordu complex, Shahid Ali Mohammadi complex, were cut using explosives. It should be recalled that power cutoff is one of the ways to break down centrifuge machines. Then, during the early hours of next morning, an agency inspectors requested to conduct an unannounced inspection. Does this visit have any connection to that detonation? Who, other than the IAEA inspectors, can have access to the complex in such a short time to record and report failures? It should be reminded that the same act had been performed on the power lines to Natanz facilities. Due to the transparency of Iran's peaceful nuclear activities and the IAEA surveillance on these activities, we have endeavored to procure our required items legitimately from the global market. The IAEA does not assist us in relation to lifting of our sanctions. Maybe it is not mandated to do so. However, when the Stuxnet virus is employed or industrial sabotage is carried out in vacuum equipments, all statistics about the number of centrifuge machines, the exact amount of enriched uranium, remaining enrichment of uranium in UF6 flowing out of the machines, and whatever observable in the area are reported by the agency truthfully and with absolute honesty. This information is easily accessible to saboteurs and terrorists through IAEA reports. On 20 May 2012, this matter of concern was explained to His Excellency the Director General and his two honorable deputies by showing a device with explosive inside, and thus we requested him not to repeat such reports. However, unfortunately, more precise details have been reflected in the latest Director General report. Samples of related pictures to these sabotage are being presented in Iran's sections in the exhibition. Plotters of attack against Iran's nuclear facilities have realized through the IAEA published reports that they have not gained any success in this regard. It is noteworthy for all those who enjoy the flourish of human talent and praise God for creating human beings. I should state that Iranian experts are now able to realize unwanted events in advance and ward off threats by targeting virtual packages of cyber attacks, industrial sabotage, and the use of explosives. they have also devised certain ways through which nuclear facilities remain intact under missile attacks and air raids. However, based on Islamic instructions, we assume everyone innocent unless the fault is proven. Hence, we request the distinguished IAEA staff to bring the agency back to the correct path and preserve it in the path of justice. The 50% increase in the number of centrifuge machines for up to 5% enrichment. And based on the IAEA report, the start up and gas feeding of 4 cascades of centrifuge machines to increase the production of 20% enriched uranium in Fort Doe, and the start up a cascade of new generation centrifuge machines, all have been the required measures to meet the needs and to deal with possible damages. Distinguished delegates, the greatest achievement resulting from all the improvements of the Islamic Republic of Iran in the field of nuclear science and technology is to create self-esteem and national confidence and to act as a model for others in the region and the whole world. A model depicting the capability of a nation to resist pressure, to preserve independence, and to break the scientific monopoly of some arrogant powers. Fuel production for Tehran Research Reactor is evidence thereto. Iran's capability in uranium exploration, extraction, processing, and enrichment up to 20%, and its conversion to U-308 with the enrichment rate of 20%, and its application in the production of fuel plates, as well as their assembly, represents our experts' resolution and capability, and it is an intellectual gift to all humanitarian nations of the world and a beginning to peaceful cooperation aimed at human beings' welfare and health. New achievements and methods to keep capabilities will be announced in due time. Like the past, we remain committed to our agreed obligations with the agency and the NPT, and we will claim our rights. We recommend that the agency change its approach with regard to Iran. The agency should seek Iran's assistance to dismiss the accusations leveled at Iran by some states hostile to Iran, and which use international forums as their instruments. It should not act in a manner that could raise doubts that it is having a mission to prove allegations. Hereby I declare that the Islamic Republic of Iran, as an IAEA member state and as a country that will always use its nuclear capability in line with peace and human beings' welfare, seeks the agency's strengthening, non-proliferation of nuclear weapons, and all-inclusive disarmament. Thus, I suggest that nuclear disarmament start with the state that has pioneered the use and proliferation of nuclear weapons and constantly seeks an imaginary enemy to continue its survival. In this regard, the agency should provide assistance to member states to improve the application of nuclear technology, and the member states shall enjoy their rights while respecting their obligations. Peaceful nuclear energy is a right given to all member states. Adopting selective and conductory approaches infringes the member states' rights. As the chair of the non-aligned movement, the Islamic Republic of Iran will defend the rights of all non-aligned movement member states. We seek to improve the unfair structure of the agency's Board of Governors. The democratic structure of the Board of Governors will lead to the strengthening of the agency. A state which has used nuclear weapons is not eligible to be present at the Board of Governors. We hope to witness happening of International Forum Spring in line with establishment of justice in the world. Distinguished delegates, the existence of the Zionist regime as well as being equipped with nuclear weapons of this Zionist mentality is a serious threat to the international peace and security, as well as to international community. Liberating Palestine from Zionist occupiers does not require the production and use of illegal nuclear weapons. Democracy and recourse to opinion of the native residents of Palestine is the principal solution and is thus recommended to all. Opposition to Iran's nuclear progress aims at maintaining the exclusiveness of the power and wealth and strengthening the foundations of colonization and modern slavery. Consider the sanctions enforced or are under enforcement against Iran. Iran's nuclear issue has removed the mask of the ugly face of colonization and modern slavery. Consider the new order and the insurance of vessels and their flags, banking and petroleum transactions, and so on. Relying on Allah and the support of our people, we strongly continue the path of freedom and independence and the Iranian technology on the earth and in the space will support all nations' quest for freedom and independence. Thank you for your attention.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. We have been listening to the statement made earlier today by Dr. Feridun Abbasi, the Vice President of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, speaking in a revelation of sabotage against an Iranian nuclear facility exactly 1 month ago today. Abbasi was addressing the 56th General Conference of the International Atomic Energy Agency. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. Today's program was engineered by Michael G. Haskins and produced with Thiago Barroso. If you have tips, comments, leaks, questions, or suggestions for 5 O'Clock Shadow, drop us an email at theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.